This is the second take in a series by Dr. Robert C. Newman, Professor of New Testament at Biblical Theological Seminary.
It's hard to tell what's going to be the importance of Smith's work. Smith's work is very parallel to Allegro's. Allegro's work came at a time of the student rebellion, when people were interested in free sex, when people were interested in hallucinogenic drugs, and naturally put on. Smith's work comes out at a time when there's an enormous interest in this early Christian heresy, Gnosticism. Several reasons for that. One is that Gnostics believe very strongly we live in a terrible world, and it couldn't possibly be made by good God. And you won't have to look too far to find that there are people today who believe we live in a terrible world. That they're okay, but the world's a mess. And they're half right, but you're aware. The world is a mess. But it's us and others like us that are responsible for it being the mess it is. It's human sin. And many people are willing to grant that human sin is real as long as you look at somebody else, but they think they're okay. That was a characteristic of Gnosticism. Gnostics believed they were spiritual, they were okay, but the world had been made by a dumb god who didn't really know what he's doing, and he mucked things up pretty thoroughly. And they're trapped in a lousy body, and he's like, get out of it. So there's a sense in which Gnosticism in the ancient world matches a lot of ideas today. The other thing is that a whole mass of these Gnostic manuscripts were discovered just after World War II down in Egypt, about the same time as these scrolls have been discovered. And they show us a lot of what these guys believe, and they've now been published in paperback as such. And so there's a lot of interest in that. Some people in the women's liberation movement are very strong on Gnosticism. They think it justifies them. They're very radical feminists. Some persons like William Smith and John Robinson and some others, again, who's the editor of such. So, in a sense, this seems to fit in very nicely with what people are interested in today. I don't know how far things are likely to go in that direction. When we get there, when we see what happens in the next 10 years. But I think this is kind of the latest in a sample of Lives of Christ that pick and choose among the biblical material, explain that it really wasn't that way after all, if we could really get behind what they say to what really happened and such. But in fact, most of what they're really doing is they are rejecting some material, expanding the other, and giving very different pictures of Jesus. I think C.S. Lewis puts his finger on what's going on right here in a remark he makes in the Screwtape Letters. If you've ever read Screwtape Letters, you're aware they're a set of imaginary letters written by a senior devil to his nephew. But he explains various techniques for turning people away from Christianity, getting them into sin, and that sort of thing. And one of the techniques, he says, is to invent a new Jesus every generation that matches what's going on in that generation. And he says it has lots of advantages. One of the advantages is it causes people to distrust the actual biblical material. Another advantage is it causes them to chase after a Jesus who doesn't really exist, and keep their attention away from the Jesus who really does exist. And of course, every generation will change him so that you will have wasted all your time following one thing instead of following another. And I think Lewis points out something that's really important as well. He points out that the scriptures really say what they say. And if you take what they say, you're going to get a particular picture, and there's really not much divergence among that. But if you begin to draw parts and emphasize other parts, you can make almost anything out of Jesus. And that, in fact, is what we've seen going on in these past 200 years. And even before that, although this idea of writing Lives of Christ from a liberal perspective has been basically a phenomenon of these last 200 years. Next week, Lord willing, we want to come back and think a little bit about what information do we have about Jesus outside the biblical materials. And we're going to find out we do have a little bit of material from pagan sources. We do have a little material from Jewish sources. And naturally, not all these people like Jesus. But even what they agree upon really throws a multi-wrench into much of what liberals would like to claim we really don't know. And of course, it's really hard on any particular one of these things as well. So we want to look a little bit at that next week, and then we want to come back and look at Paul's testimony next week, the following week, and then each of the Gospels, look at what they say about Jesus, and what evidence they have that they really went back to somebody who knew something about these matters, and he's concerned to tell about these matters rather than he had something to them. And that, of course, I think, is what we're really concerned about. What, in fact, did happen, not what can we make up that we'd kind of like to believe 2,000 years later. We'd like to look in most of the rest of the course had a response to this and kind of a little introduction to the Gospels. What we'd like to do this evening is show that, in fact, we do have other material from the early centuries AD, particularly we're going to look at material that, as far as we know, nearly all of it comes from, say, before 200 AD, that show us that, indeed, there was other knowledge about Jesus out there, not as much as we might perhaps like, but still a good bit. We want to look this hour at extra-biblical sources about Jesus that are pagan in perspective, Gentile, and then next hour, some extra-biblical material about Jesus from a Jewish perspective. We're going to find that some of these sources are hostile and some of these sources are more neutral, if you like, but that they do give us some insights into things which are regularly denied in modern liberal life of Christ, and suggesting that there really is historical evidence for some of these things, even ignoring the biblical material, and that some of the things which liberals think it is most important to affirm about Jesus are in fact denied by the these extra-biblical accounts. We'd like to look, first of all, under the pagan sources, at two important Roman historians who were living in the same century of the foundation of Christianity, though both of them were born after the time of Jesus' public ministry, who wrote about the century of Jesus' public ministry, and who were writing, in fact, early in the next century. One of these fellows is known as Suetonius. His actual name is Gaius Suetonius Tranquillus, but he goes by that, you might call it, middle name, if not really a middle name. Suetonius was probably one of the more popular history writers of the ancient world. He had a flair for the juicy story. He was therefore perhaps like some of the popular cult writers today who were writing historical type work, but looking for all the scandals and that sort of thing. And in Rome, it was not hard to find plenty of scandals. The work that we have from Suetonius was originally called Lives of the Caesars, but since after his death, there were Caesars for another 400 years, the modern title is usually Lives of the 12 Caesars, because he discusses the first 12 persons who had that title. This particular work, then, is a rather important one, discussing the first 12 Caesars. We have two very brief comments in this work that seem to refer to Jesus. One of them, I think, is questionable whether it's about Jesus or not, but I think we can make a fairly good argument that it is. If you look on the top of your paper here of the handouts, or if you look on page 53, you'll see this little short quotation. Suetonius is discussing the life of the Emperor Claudius. And Claudius was emperor from 41 to 54 A.D. He's right before Nero, who is far better known, and right after Caligula, who you may or may not have run into, depending on how much history reading you've done, whether you've watched the right or wrong movies at the theaters and such. But this fellow was named Claudius, and in the middle of a discussion of things that are going on in Claudius's reign, Suetonius says, since the Jews constantly made disturbances at the instigation of one Crestus, he expelled them from Rome. Now, we know from the New Testament that the Jews were expelled from Rome by Claudius, and we have an approximate date from just fitting in with the Jewish chronology, and that's this remark in Acts 18:2. If you've got your Bible, you might turn to that, have a quick look at it here. Paul has just given his Areopagus speech in Athens in the last part of chapter 17 of Acts. After this, Paul left Athens and went to Corinth. There he met a Jew named Aquila, a native of Pontus, who had recently come from Italy with his wife Priscilla, because Claudius had ordered all the Jews to leave Rome. And Paul goes to live with them, and they're tent makers, and he has training in that trade, apparently, and he's going into evangelization in Corinth. What's interesting here is his name, Crestus. In Latin, this is pronounced a little bit different than the usual word for Christ, which is Christus, but that word's not a Latin word at all. The word Christus, in fact, is a Greek word, and it's not a Greek name. It's a word for one who has been anointed, one who has had oil, ceremonial oil poured over them. And that, of course, was done some in Roman society, although it was not as important in Roman society as it was in Jewish society. But a word pronounced almost exactly the same in Greek is this word spelled, which is easier in English or Latin. which would be pronounced, both of them actually would be pronounced Christos in Greek, pronounced the same way, spelled differently. But this particular word is a word that was probably a common slave name. It means something like pleasant, something like that. A number of the slaves who are born in a family that is born in a slave were given the sort of useful names rather than the names that they probably would have chosen themselves. So you have this fellow Onesimus, whose name means useful, as one of the figures in the New Testament. Well, my guess is here that probably this is a mistake for the name Christus. And the writer, that did not make sense to him, but the idea of the Greek slave name did make sense to him. With the same pronunciation, but a slightly different spelling, that's probably what happened. What this would suggest, then, is not that Christ was in Rome making disturbances among the Jews, but that probably the disturbances between Jewish non-believers and Jewish believers had caused some troubles in Rome. You think back about Paul's ministry, everywhere he went, he got into troubles with the Jews, usually. Not all the Jews, some Jews believed. But the ones who didn't usually seem very violent against him, and then start riots in three or four places against him. The suggestion here would be something of the same sort of happened with the gospel in Rome, although Paul was not involved in that particular thing so much later. And so here is a writer who knows very little about it, but that there was some kind of riot, the Jews were kicked out of Rome, and lo and behold, he has it then at the instigation of one Crestus. Sounds very much like a second or third hand account that the writer doesn't know a lot about. This also fits in rather well with Acts 18 too, because there's nothing to say about Paul evangelizing before them. He goes to live with them, and very quickly they're his associates in the work. And that was fitting very nicely if they were Jewish Christians who had come from Rome, and as Claudius threw them out, naturally the Jewish Christians had to leave as well as the Jewish non-Christians. Well, that's obviously not a very high-powered reference there, although it's perhaps the earliest allusion that we have in an outside source. That is a reference in a source back to one of the earliest events that happened at least in Rome. When we move later on in Suetonius' account, we come into the section of his work he calls Nero. He named just for the 12 Caesars there. And in chapter 16, book 16, chapter 2, I guess, we have a whole list of things that Nero had done in his rule. And I give you a little bit of the front of this context. During his reign, many abuses were severely punished and put down, and then there's a whole list of various things that he stopped the chariot drivers from cheating their customers, and he made some rules about buying food in the various restaurants and things like that. And then in the middle of it, we have this remark: punishment was inflicted on Christians, a class of men given to a new and mischievous superstition. And about what we find here, which is by Nero's time, would be 54 to 68 A.D., that Christianity has apparently reached Rome to such an extent that the writer gets the name right and knows it as some kind of a title for a religious group of some sort. I don't know whether he knew much about it or not. He knew it was a new religion that it was reaching. He thought it was mischievous. You'll see why he makes the remark in that direction when we look at the passage with some more detail. The term superstition doesn't mean a whole lot in Roman circles. It has a little of flavor of the English word superstition, but it basically means a non-Roman religion, but doesn't have too good connotations. The Romans were concerned about foreign religions coming in, but they managed to keep coming in through all of Roman history from about 40 BC up to the end of the Roman Empire. Well, that's about all we've got in Suetonius. Doesn't tell us a whole lot. There's some kind of group called Christians. Maybe this fellow with the right about Christus had something to do with it. Frequently, they have a group named for some person that they look up to or found or something like that. Remember the New Testament term Herodians, something to do with Herod. When we move over to Cornelius Tacitus, however, our second Roman historian, and probably the more important historian of the period, we find out a good deal more about Christianity and about Jesus. Tacitus was probably never as popular a writer as Suetonius was, but he's considered a much more reliable writer. He's got his biases too, like nearly every other writer does, but he seems to be more concerned to report what happened and not scouting around to dig up the dirt sort of idea that Suetonius C, for engaging. B, Tacitus wrote a couple of different works, one called The Histories and another called The Annals. And it's this work called The Annals that we're interested in. Not all of it has even survived to our present time. There are a couple of passages, a couple of periods where we'd like to get some information that we don't have the book of The Annals for that particular passage. But we do have a very interesting reference to Christianity and the Christ in his discussion of the Roman fire. To say a word about the fire itself. In the summer of 64 AD, in July of 64 AD, a fire started in the evening. I think it was the evening of the 18th, but I don't have the information in my notes here. It might be wrong enough. A fire broke out in Rome, and it burned for several days. It could not stop it. The weather was such that the firefighters could not stop it until it burned down a substantial fraction of the city of Rome at that time. Immediately after the fire was over, Nero, by the way, was out of town when it happened, and he came back very quickly after the fire got going, and one night stood up on the top of his palace and looked at the fire burning there, and he was so moved by the emotion of it that he began to play an ode to the burning of Troy, and he didn't fiddle while Rome burned, as the old proverb goes. They didn't have fiddles back then, but he played on the harp, a lyre, and sang that he imagined himself to be something of a of a performer. In fact, he won all the contests he was in after he became emperor, but it was very dangerous for the judges not to let him win. We don't really know quite what his actual talent was. Well, so Tacitus narrates for us the fire, the firefighting, and then the attempts to solve things after that. And he explains various things Nero did and such. And then in Book 15, Section 44, we come into our passage here. But neither human help, nor imperial munificence, that is, the emperor putting up money to straighten out things, nor all the modes of placating heaven, various attempts to quiet the gods down, could stifle scandal or dispel the belief that the fire had taken place by order. There were rumors going around that Nero started the fire. It was claimed, we really don't know whether it's true or not, it was claimed, and both Suetonius and Tacitus mentioned this, that that persons who were known to be Nero's servants were found hindering the firefighting, throwing flammable material on the fire, and things of that sort. And we really don't know the answer to that. And certainly the rumor was doubtless believed by many when Nero took the empty part of Rome that had been burnt out and cleared a great deal of the palace satisfaction of downtown Rome. So that was that was what this remark is about, that it had taken place by order. Therefore, to scotch the rumor, Nero substituted culprits and punished with the utmost refinement of cruelty a class of men loathed for their vices, whom the crowd styled Christians. Crispus, the founder of the name, had undergone the death penalty in the reign of Tiberius, earlier in his reign from 14 to 37 AD, by sentence of the procurator Pontius Pilate, the governor of Judea, who reigned from 26 to 36 AD. And the pernicious superstition was checked for a moment, only to break out once more, not merely in Judea, the home of the disease, but in the capital itself, that is in Rome, where all things horrible or shameful in the world collect and find a vote. This, interestingly, is the only reference to Pontius Pilate in all the Roman histories. In fact, in all the Gentile histories, the only reference to non-Christian Gentile history, only reference to Pontius Pilate. We'll find Josephus, a Jewish historian, makes reference to him. Pilate got his name down in Roman history for one event, what he did with Jesus. well, first then, the confessed members of the sect were arrested. Next, on their disclosures, vast numbers were convicted, not so much on account of arson as for hatred of the human race. In derision accompanied their end. They were covered with wild beast skins and torn to death by dogs, or they were fastened on crosses, and when daylight failed, were burned to serve as lamps by night. Nero had offered his gardens for a spectacle and gave an exhibition in the circus, mixing with a crowd in the habit dress of a charioteer, or mounted on his car chariot. Hence, in spite of the guilt, which had earned the most exemplary punishment, there arose a sentiment of pity, giving the impression that they were being sacrificed not for the welfare of the state, but for the ferocity of a single man. You really see that explicit statement of the Christianity. It's obviously not a very positive one. That's because it's a very low view of Christianity. We don't know too much what he knows about it, but he knows he is aware of some kind of charges of vices. We can guess what he has in mind here from some writings of Christian apologists in the 2nd century who point out that certain charges are standardly made against Christians. There's a charge made against them that they engage in orgies in their secret meetings, because Christian meetings were not open to public in the earliest time. Apparently, they had the Lord's Supper and such, and perhaps a closed communion, and if people who were not believers didn't come in for services. And then there was some claim that they ate babies, and they didn't warrants for that. But by the way, something fairly similar to that was a charge against Jews in this period as well. The idea that they would, the Passover feast were actually eating Gentile babies and Jews eat babies. So the kind of scandal that often went around against Jews that were very much hated. The remark about hatred of the human race there in the middle of the quotation, I would guess, refers to Christians preaching against sin. Many, many people, since Christians, hate non-Christians because they accuse them of all of these things. And many times the non-Christians give back what they get. It may also suggest why Nero chose the Christians to blame the fire on. If we can guess from the New Testament, we would not be, I think, surprised to think that early Christians might have warned of the wrath of God to come and the world being consumed by fire and such. And so when the fire broke out, you might say they had been accused of that sort of thing. So here we have the second, in fact, probably the most important Roman historian of the 1st century A.D., Cornelius Crassus, and this is really what he knows about Jesus. Notice what we have there, right in the middle of it. Christus, the founder of the name, the founder of Christianity, Christus, had undergone the death penalty in the reign of Tiberius by the sentence of the procurator Pontius Pilate. I think it's a safe guess at this point that Castus thinks that's what Jesus' name is, Christus. He doesn't seem to know anything else about his name. Not too surprising. There are lots of people today that think Christ is Jesus' name. And in fact, it's a title. The Anointed One, the Messiah, etc. The title. You would find many people in the street today that would not know that. You should not be surprised that a Roman historian would not know that. Third person we want to look at, we really don't know the data for sure. Suggestions range from perhaps shortly after 70 AD to about 200 or a little after as the date of this particular writer. We don't really know a lot about Suetonius and Tacitus, but we do know that both of them were persons who had access to official Roman records. They were important historians and such. This fellow, we know nothing about except what he tells us about himself in the one letter he gave. One other survivor of this fellow, Mara Bar Serapion. From that, we can figure out that the fellow is a Syrian, that is, he is from Syria, the area there north of Palestine, that he is a Stoic philosopher, that is, he had accepted the teachings of the Stoics, one of the important philosophies of New Testament time, that he's in jail, and according to him, he's writing to his son, he's unjustly charged, to give the fellow a break. We don't know all the ins and outs about that. And so he's basically, in the letter, he's moralizing on what's happened to himself and comparing it to what has happened to other great philosophers in history. And so we come in then with this particular remark that he's got here. What else have we to say when wise men are forcibly dragged by the hands of tyrants and their wisdom is taken captive by calumnies and they are oppressed in their intelligence without defense? I think we can guess from that that's what happened to him, that he had been taken by a tyrant, local governor of some sort probably, and had been thrown in jail, and that calumny was involved. Somebody had accused him falsely or had made some false charge against him, and that he was not allowed to make the defense. That sounds like what's going on. And then he begins to give examples from previous history. What advantage did the Athenians gain by the murder of Socrates, the recompense of which they received in famine and pestilence? So there's that, the Greek philosopher Socrates, and he was put to death by the Athenians. You may know a little about that. That's one of the best memories here, the idea that he was forced to drink a poisonous liquid as a death penalty. Or the people of Samos by the burning of Pythagoras, because in 1 hour their country was entirely covered with sand. Or the Jews by the death of their wise king, because from that time their kingdom was taken away. For with justice did God make recompense to the wisdom of these three. For the Athenians died of famine, and the Samians were overwhelmed by the sea without remedy, and the Jews, desolately driven from their own kingdom, are scattered through every country. Socrates is not dead, because of Plato, neither Pythagoras, because of the statue of Juno, nor the wise king, because of the laws he promulgated. Well, we're not particularly interested here in either Socrates or Pythagoras, so let's skip over what they did, although there's a parallelism all through the passage. What did the Athenians get out of killing Socrates? What did the Samians get out of killing Pythagoras? What did the Jews get out of killing their wise king? God recompensed each three of them. He dealt justly with them. And then you get the famine that took place in Athens shortly after the death of Pythagoras. You get the Samians overwhelmed by the sea. I don't know the ins and outs of that. And the Jews driven from their own kingdom, scattered throughout the area. And then so-and-so is not dead because of this. And he picks something about each one. Plato, one of the students of Socrates, immortalized him by using him in many of his dialogues. But Socrates himself had nothing written, and so on here. So what we learn about someone here is that he is a wise king whom the Jews put to death, that after that time they lost their kingdom, that as a result of it they are scattered through every country, and yet the wise king didn't die because his law had failed. Well, we know of nobody in Jewish history that would fit that but Jesus. And here we have a claim in of his being a philosopher, as seen from a Stoic perspective, of his being a king in some sense, and whether the writer understands what that is all about, we don't know. He was put to death by the Jews. Following that, they were scattered, and of course, the revolt of the Jews in 66 to 70 resulted in the end of any kind of Jewish kingdom. And this person promulgated laws, yes, of course, he did. So that's what we've got. We don't know for sure. Probably Mara did not know his name. He named the other two, but probably he did not know Jesus' name. What we do see here, however, is he knew something about a claim to kingship. And this is probably how he would represent the messiahship, which the Roman historians apparently just take the proper name, but which we can see behind the name is actually a claim to messiahship. Here, the Assyrian writer apparently is aware that it's a claim, and so translates it into king, which would be more easily understood, and knows something about some kind of teaching, and knows they are put to death, right? Knows they are put to death by the Jews. Okay, that then is the third source. The fourth source is not strictly a historian. He is a Roman governor. This fellow, Pliny the Younger, was governor of one of the Roman provinces. If you look on a map of Asia Minor during New Testament times, maybe you've got one in your Bible, up near the top of the map here, near the top of Asia Minor, you'll see a little section called Bithynia. Paul was headed for that on his second missionary journey, and he was turned aside by the Spirit of the Lord to go to the Troas and then go into Europe. The province of Bithynia. We don't know the exact date, but it looks like it's around 111, 112, something like that. The date of his governorship, I've actually got 105 to 110 down here. That's, I think, perhaps just a couple of years too early. The main work we have from Pliny the Younger is a group of letters. He was a wealthy person, all of the governors in Roman history, and he was literate, a good writer, and at that particular time in history, a popular literary pastime was writing letters. And you might write these to a friend or something, but you often take very great care that they're written very carefully so that you could publish them. And so letters to your friends and forth back and forth are a part of what these letters are concerned about. But one whole volume of these letters come from the time when he was governor, and they are letters back and forth between Pliny and the Roman emperor, Trajan, appointed by the emperor, as there for several years, and he sends letters back and forth. This particular set of letters then involved his largely asking advice. Pliny was wise in knowing that it was very dangerous as a governor to do anything that might appear to be too innovative, because the emperors could come down on you while they were doing it. And yet, it was somewhat dangerous to be too cautious either. And so his procedure was to write and get advice from the emperor anytime there was any question about what was going on. Well, as we'll see in this letter of his that we're going to read, one whole letter is about the question of how do you try Christians, what punishment do you give them, and that sort of thing. Apparently, Pliny, as we'll see from the letter, had never been at a trial of Christians, but Christianity is illegal during this period, and so he does what he would think is a natural thing to do from his illegal experience, and then writes to the emperor to see if he can find out what's going on here. Here are the people with the handout sheets that dip slightly, because they don't give you the full reply of Trajan to him, but for those with the got the whole thing. Here we go. This is Book 10, Letter 96. It is my custom to refer all my difficulties to you, sir, the sire, that's the emperor talking to, for no one is better able to resolve my doubts and to inform my opinion. I have never been present at an examination of Christians, meaning a trial of Christians. Consequently, I do not know the nature or the extent of the punishment usually meted out to them, nor the grounds for starting an investigation and how far it should be pressed. Nor am I at all sure whether any distinction should be made between them on the grounds of age, or if young people and adults should be treated alike. Whether a pardon ought to be granted to anyone retracting his beliefs, or if he has once professed Christianity, he shall gain nothing by renouncing it. And whether it is the mere name of Christian, which is punishable, even if innocent of crime, or rather the crime is associated with a name. Same reference to apparently the charge of cannibalism and torture and that sort of thing I implied there. For the moment, this is the line I have taken with all persons brought before me on the charge of being Christian. I have asked them in person if they were Christians. And if they admit it, I repeat the question a second and third time with a warning of the punishment awaiting them. If they persist, I order them to be led away for execution. For whatever the nature of their admission, I am convinced that their stubbornness and unshakable obstinacy ought not to go unpunished. There have been others similarly fanatical who are Roman Christians, Roman citizens, excuse me. I have entered them on the list of persons to be sent to Rome for trial. Roman governors didn't have the right to put to death citizens unless they were in the middle of doing some kind of treasonous crime or something to send them off to Rome. You realize that from the remarks of Paul in the Book of Acts. Now that I've begun to deal with this problem, as so often happens, the charges are becoming more widespread and increasing in variety. An anonymous pamphlet has been circulated which contains the names of a number of accused persons. Among these, I considered that I should dismiss any who denied that they were or ever had been Christians when they had repeated after me a formula of invocation to the gods and had made offerings of wine and incense to your statue, which I had ordered to be brought into court for this purpose, long image of the gods, and furthermore had reviled the name of Christ, none of which things I understand any genuine Christian can be induced to do. Others, whose names were given to me by an informer, first admitted the charge and then denied it. They said that they had ceased to be Christians 2 or more years previously, and some of them even 20 years ago. They all did reverence to your statue and the image of the gods in the same way as the other, and reviled the name of Christ. They also declared that the sum total of their guilt or error amounted to no more than this. They had met regularly before dawn on a fixed day to chant verses alternately among themselves in honor of Christ, a gift to God, and also to bind themselves by oath, not for any criminal purpose, but to abstain from theft, robbery, and adultery, to commit no breach of trust, and not to deny a deposit when called upon to restore it. After this ceremony, it had been their custom to disperse and reassemble later to take food of an ordinary farmer's kind, in allusion to the charges of being there. But they had, in fact, given up this practice since my edict, issued on your instructions, which banned all political societies. This made me decide that it was all the more necessary to extract the truth by torture from 2 slave women whom they called deaconesses. I found nothing but a degenerate sort of cult carried to extravagant lengths. So you see, apparently he was suspicious of all these charges, and this is all that these people admitted who had been Christians, what was really going on. So he tortures a couple of women who are directed deaconesses, so he doesn't find anything additional, just a religious thing that comes to it. I have therefore postponed any further examination and hastened to consult you. The question seems to me to be worthy of your consideration, especially in view of the number of persons in danger. And so obviously there are some Christians, otherwise why torture him? He wants to find out what this all is all about, and he doesn't find out anything that apparently contradicts what he had found before. He presumably mentioned it since he's trying to get information to the emperor. may pick up on that sentence. The question seems to me to be worthy of your consideration, especially in view of the number of persons endangered. For a great many individuals of every age and class, those men and women are being brought to trial, and this is likely to continue. It is not only the towns, but villages and rural districts, too, which are infected through contact with this wrecked cult. I think, though, that it is still possible for it to be checked and directed to better ends, for there is no doubt that people have begun to throng the temples, which had been almost entirely deserted for a long time. The sacred rites, as pagan rites we're talking about here, which had been allowed to lapse, are being performed again, and flesh of sacrificial victims is on sale everywhere. That's talking about animals, not people. In other words, now animals that have been sacrificed in the temple, after that's done, the priests sell it in the meat market. Flesh sacrificial victims is on sale everywhere, though up till recently, scarcely anyone could be found to buy it. It is easy to infer from this that a great many people should be might in there, be reformed, if they were given an opportunity to repent. So what we see here is that by about 110 in Bithynia, Christianity had become so dominant that people weren't going to the pagan temple, that they wouldn't buy meat that had gone through the pagan temples and back to the meat market. They wouldn't buy at the meat market. So nobody could sell it. And so you really get an impression that a very large fraction of the population of Bithynia had become Christian at this point. Well, so he writes for this advice, and that's really his whole letter there. Trajan to Pliny. Next letter. You have followed the right course of procedure, my dear Pliny, in your examination of the cases of persons charged with being Christian. For it's impossible to lay down general rules with this formula. These people must not be hunted out. If they are brought before you, and the charge against them is proved, they must be punished. But in the case of anyone who denies that he's a Christian and makes it clear that he's not by offering prayers to our gods, he is to be pardoned as a result of his repentance, however suspect his past conduct may be. The pamphlet circulated anonymously must play no part in any accusation. It creates the worst sort of precedent, and they're quite out of keeping with the spirit of our age. The answer that Trajan sends back is a little strange, if you think about it. And Christian apologists in the next century will quickly point this out. What other crime is it that you can deny that you did it in the pardon? So basically what the apologists point out. And it suggests that there's something going on here of a very strange sort. If a person was charged with being a murderer and he said, no, I'm not a murderer, or, yeah, I was a murderer, but I repent of it, he would not get off in either case if the evidence was quite good that he was. But here you have something very, very different. And it suggests that whatever the Romans were scared about with regard to Christians, it was they're continuing to believe what they believed. As best we can tell, Christianity became illegal at the time, right after the Roman fire. Nero made it illegal. And apparently the charges brought forward then made it look like Christianity was subversive. And so it continued to be understood as subversive all through the period we see here, and really up to about 300 AD, when Constantine adopted Christianity. Let's quickly then try and summarize all of this. For you that have a syllabus, this is on page 58. I've put together a list of things we learn about Jesus from these pagan sources. And you notice on there the little stars indicate that we learn about the same things in Jewish sources as well. We learn, first of all, that Jesus lived in Judea in the reign of Tiberius. We find out from other sources, lots of sources give us the dates of Tiberius' reign. That would be between 14 and 37 AD. However, the name Jesus is never used. You know, all of these examples, all of them are Christus and the one wise king. We see, secondly, that some kind of messianic claim was ascribed to him. The three Roman historians use the term Christ or the derivative Christian. And I suspect they don't even realize the title. But from our knowledge of Greek, and particularly Greek is used by Jews, we know the title of Messiah. Mashiach in Hebrew is the word for anointed one. And in going over to Greek, rather than just carrying over the word, they translate it into Greek, which is Christos. And then we have this king reference in Mark, which will also be a messianic claim. Thirdly, we get the idea that he was apparently some kind of a teacher. Romans refer to what he started as a superstition, a standard term they use for religion. He sounded like a religious teacher of some sort. And then Mara, who seems to be rather favorable to Jesus, calls him a wise king, the teachings, the law that he promulgated. Fourthly, We learn that he was put to death by Pontius Pilate from Tacitus, and put to death by the Jews from Mark. Both of those speakers. One shows up in one historian and shows up in another historian. We'll find the same thing happens among the Jewish historians. One of them pictures his death as being by the Jews, another pictures his death being by the Roman Pontius Pilate. Fifthly, his followers, called Christians, continued after his death. Pontius was rather explicit about this when he's talking about Christians in 110 AD. And Mark says he lives on in the law, so there must be somebody following the laws, if the laws are living on. And then this last one, rather interesting, comes out of verse 20. These followers worship Jesus as God, though they would not worship the gods. They were regularly willing to endure torture and death rather than not affect that. So I think you can see here the influence that Jesus has had even within a generation of his time at faraway Rome. And by the time you get 70 years away, two generations away in Bithynia, it looks like enough of the population has become Christian that paganism has almost collapsed in that area. And it requires the persecuting force of the Roman state to pump it up again. And that, in fact, is what finally happens over the whole Roman Empire in several centuries, that paganism almost collapses under the Roman rule. Okay, we're going to stop. And here next time, we'll take a look at the Jewish sources. Josephus was born in 37 AD. In Jerusalem, apparently, so born just after the events of Jesus' ministry. He died around 100. We don't know exactly. Apparently, just a year or two after, but we don't have an exact date on that. Josephus is, in many ways, I think, the most important extra-biblical source of information about New Testament history, Intertestament history, and those sorts of things. Whereas all the Roman historians put together mentioned Pilate once, Josephus must mention Pilate dozens of times. Josephus mentions Annas and Caiaphas. Josephus mentions Herod the Great. Mentions Herod Agrippa the First, the fellow who dies in Acts chapter 11, I believe it is. Mentions Herod Agrippa the Second, the fellow called Agrippa, whom Paul appears before in Acts 26, I think, right. And he mentions his sister Bernice, and mentions John the Baptist and a number of other people. So if you're going to buy one book on extra-biblical material on history of the New Testament times, the thing to buy would be a copy of Josephus. Unfortunately, the only cheap edition of Josephus, a paperback, orange and black striped thing for about $15, is translated about 1700 and is not in the most readable English you might find. The ones that are translated in nice readable English cost you $25 to $100, so not as much. I would be quite surprised if your library doesn't have a copy of Josephus. Good asterisk, but I suspect it probably did. Anyway, we're going to look at one of his works. He wrote one work about 80 AD called The War of the Jews, which narrated his own part and then what happened afterward in the revolt of the Jews against Rome that took place from 66 to 73 AD. Very possibly some of you saw the series Masada on the TV a couple of years ago. Almost all of the information out of that that's historical comes from Josephus. There's some archaeological things that they got elsewhere, and there's quite a bit of imagination that the writers put in. But almost everything that's historical comes out of Josephus' account of that particular event. There's the wars that led up to it. So he's a very important person. However, the war starts in, it has a quick rundown before it gets to the beginning of the war, but actually runs through about 100 years of history very quickly, and then picks up in 66 with the war and runs on 73. So not as much interest to us as a work he wrote later in his life called Antiquities, actually The Antiquities of the Jews. And that work starts at creation and follows the Bible with a few legendary editions scattered here and there, traditional editions scattered here and there through the first material. But then eventually run through the end of the Bible and gets out of the Old Testament period and has lots of information there that we don't have sources of anymore, follows a couple of sources we've still got around, and then comes down and finally stops at 66. They stop the Old Testament, which is intended to be a supplement to the other, and just shows something about the history of the Jews. There are two passages in Antiquities that refer to Jesus. We're going to look at the later one first because there's less argument about the authenticity of the later one, and then we'll come back to look at the earlier one. This is book 20 of Josephus. His Antiquities was written in 20 books, so this is the last book. And it's up within just a few years. I think it's talking about around 62 AD. When it's getting here. And it's been describing the character of a fellow named Ananus, who has just become high priest, and says he's very rash and daring in his character. And it mentions that the Roman governor, Festus, has just died. Festus is the fellow who comes on the scene while Paul is in prison in Caesarea, and has the trial, and Paul appeals to Caesar. This is just about 2 or 3 years after the time that Josephus picks up here, or at least we pick up here in Josephus with this remark. Possessed of such a character, rash, daring, etc., Ananus thought he had a favorable opportunity because Festus was dead and Albinus was still on the way. The word of the death of the governor had to get back to the emperor. The emperor had to appoint a new governor. Nobody on the scene had the authority to do what the governor could do. I mean, there was obviously a general around who keeps a riot from being at hand. But there just wasn't anybody. You didn't have an assistant governor or a vice governor or something who automatically took over all the powers. When the guy was dead, word had to get back to Rome. The emperor had to figure out who would be a good replacement, appoint the fellow, and he would probably come to Rome and then be sent out. So you're talking some months. Possessed of such a character, Ananus thought he had a favorable opportunity because Festus was dead and Albinus was still on the way. And so he convened the judges of Sanhedrin and brought before him a man named James, the brother of Jesus, who was called the Christ, and certain others. He accused him of having transgressed the law and delivered him up to be stoned. That's all we have right there. Goes on to say in the passage that a number of the pious Jews were outraged that he had acted this way to put James to death, and that they managed to speak to the governor when he arrived and speak to King Herod Agrippa II, who was not king of Palestine, but king of another territory, and between them they deposed the high priest, including the high priest. So we see several things interesting here. We see a little bit about James, the Lord's brother, a fellow who was active at the Jerusalem Council, and he's talking to Paul in Acts 21 just before Paul's arrest. Here's the death, his death. And this reference here to Jesus in sort of an offhand way. Jesus, the so-called Christ. All I bring this up for is that here's a pretty definite reference to Jesus, the so-called Christ, or Jesus, the one called Christ, in the passage. And the reason I bring it up is because there's considerable dispute on whether the other passage is authentic. The other passage occurs 2 books earlier in Josephus, back during the time of Pontius Pilate. And Josephus has just been sketching several things that Pilate has done during his career as governor of Palestine for the 10 years. I list a few of those on page 59 of the syllabus. He's got a syllabus. And then we have this remark. About this time there lived Jesus, a wise man, if indeed one ought to call him a man. For he was one who wrought surprising feats and was a teacher of such people as accept the truth gladly. He won over many Jews and many of the Greeks. He was the Messiah. When Pilate, upon hearing him accused by men of the highest standing amongst us, had condemned him to be crucified, those who had at the first place come to love him did not give up their affection for him. On the third day he appeared to them restored to life, for the prophets of God had prophesied these and countless other marvelous things about him. And the tribe of Christians, so-called after him, has still to this day not disappeared. As I point out here, I think that's a little bit in front of you. There are two things very suspicious about this passage. And that is, one, wondering whether he is a man, which is a strange thing for a non-Christian to wonder about Jesus. And the other one is the very straight remark, he was the Messiah. Both of those sound extremely Christian, and there have been several possibilities alleged for that. One possibility is that this passage is authentic, and this is what Josephus said there, because Josephus became a Christian late in his life. Now, we don't have any evidence from anywhere else that Josephus became a Christian, though we do know that the Jews considered him a traitor for having switched sides in the Roman War. I won't go into a long story, that very interesting story of how he switched sides. He was a general defending one of the cities against the Romans at one point in the war, and by the end of the war, he was a close associate of the Emperor Vespasian and helping his son conduct, well, wasn't helping him conduct the war, but was present at the destruction of Greece and the destruction of the Roman side. It's possible that having been rejected by the Jews, he looked with more interest in the Jesus than found out some of these sorts of things. We'll have reason to believe that that's probably not correct from some remarks we make here further, but it's certainly a possibility. another suggestion has been made is, yes, the passage originally was written by Josephus as it stands here, but he's mocking Christians. he doesn't really do what it says. I've read through all of Josephus, and I can't find any other passages that are like that, where the writer is mocking somebody and saying something tongue-in-cheek over any such length of passage as that. So I'm inclined to go in the direction that probably most historians are with this passage, and that is to suggest that this passage was either supplied in its entirety or modified from what was actually there to move it in a Christian direction by some copyist along the line. We need to realize that the Josephus was not transmitted to us by the Jews, written by Jewish historians around 100 AD. Doubtless it was copied by secular copyists for the next 100 years or so, as long as it was an interesting book to stay in print. I don't know how long that ran. But then, because Christians were particularly interested in it, because it told a lot of the background in the New Testament, it came to be copied by Christians, and all through the Middle Ages it was copied by Christians. And all of our copies come from the Middle Ages that we have of Josephus. We do, however, know that as early as about 325 AD, a Christian historian is citing this passage in the form we have here. So if this was changed from its original form to some Christian form, it was changed between the 100 AD and 325. So we really don't know the answer to that beyond any question. I looked at this other passage to suggest that, in fact, Josephus mentions Jesus in such an offhanded way in chapter 20 that you kind of get the idea that he must have referred to him before, as though he's alluding to something you know about and could not very well expect Jesus to know about it unless he said something about it earlier. So my guess is that we are looking at a passage that's probably been modified from that. Possible that Josephus himself modified it if he became a Christian after he wrote his first edition of Antiquities, or it's possible that that it was modified by a copyist along that line. We're all aware that Christians are not sinless, and sometimes Christians, like everybody else, like to make stories better than they were before and such, and it's conceivable that some such thing happened, although it would have had to happen here fairly early. However, in just the last 10 years, a Jewish scholar has noticed that there's an extract of this passage in a history of the world, I think the universal history, written by Agapius, an Arabic bishop from an area around Baghdad, the town of Mabug. And this history was written in the 10th century AD, and we've got some manuscripts of it. Not too much later than that, and therefore almost as early as the earliest manuscripts we have of Josephus. What we have in this particular work is an extract, an epitome, we might call it, of Josephus' statement here. It's very common in antiquity when somebody wrote a long history of something for somebody to borrow pieces out of it, but to shorten them in order to fit for the size work he was doing. Many, many of the works in antiquity were the whole work was shortened and more popular. Consumption. We do some of that today. Reader's Digest obviously does that. Goes through and takes magazine articles and shortens them, takes books and shortens them, and that sort of thing. And that was much more valuable in antiquity than this day, because books cost so much more. Everything had to be hand-copied. So to pay somebody that was literate and who could copy with a good hand to write a book out for you. And obviously then books cost much more like what cars do today than like what books do, even though books have gotten out of hand in the last 10 years. They're still cheap compared with what they used to be in antiquity. So we've got this extract here from Agapius, and here we have, I pick up a little ahead of the quotation, similarly Josephus the Hebrew, for he says in the treatises that he has written on the governance of the Jews, at this time there was a wise man who was called Jesus. His conduct was good, and he was known to be virtuous, and many people from among the Jews and other nations became his disciples. Pilate condemned him to be crucified and to die, but those who had become his disciples did not abandon his discipleship. They reported that he appeared to them 3 days after his crucifixion and that he was alive. Accordingly, he was perhaps the Messiah, concerning whom the prophets had recounted wonders. This is what is said by Josephus and his companions of our Lord, the Messiah. Well, what's interesting about that one is it says he was perhaps the Messiah, and you'll find Jews who are willing to say that today. So that's certainly not anything outrageous that he might have said, although it would indicate Josephus might be fairly seriously considering some such thing. And then it calls him a wise man who is called Jesus, rather than if indeed it be right to call him a man. It doesn't make any sense to deity and such. otherwise, it's pretty well the same passage. It does not mention that the Jews made charges against Jesus, and as a result of that, Pilate put him to death. But that's the sort of thing that might get edited down in a extract or something, in the convention, to believe that. Whereas it's hardly likely that a Christian historian would have edited out of a passage he was the Messiah, if that's what the teachers had actually said. Or if it's right to call him a man, it's not likely he would have edited that out either. So I'm inclined to think that we probably got a closer approximation to what Josephus originally wrote, though that wouldn't solve the question of whether possibly Josephus wasn't considering the claims of Christ at that time and might have become a Christian further up. But we don't know anything about that. So it's a hard to say more about that. That's Josephus. He is really the only early Jewish writer we have that says anything about Jesus, but he's really the only early Jewish writer we have when you stop and think about it. For a writer who's written after the time of Jesus, he is it until you get up to the rabbinic literature, and the rabbinic literature is all from 200 AD or later. You can look at one passage out of the rabbinic literature. Here's next. At New Testament times, you have references to the traditions of the fathers, and they come up for a little discussion in the Sermon on the Mount. You have heard that it was said, but I say to you, almost certainly referring to the oral tradition of the rabbis. And Jesus remarked elsewhere that the rabbis, by their oral tradition, invalidate God's law. They say, God's law says you should honor your father and your mother, but the rabbis say, if you say that this material is a gift of the temple, then you don't have to use it to support your parents. When you look into that, that basically means that if you dedicate your material, your goods to the temple, they'll be yours until you die. But you can't use them to support your parents because it's already been dedicated and that is cut down the size of your state or something. And Jesus goes into that rather strongly as a perversion of the biblical law. There are several other places where things of that sort have happened by New Testament time. The idea that since you can only go about 2,000 feet journey on a Sabbath day, and that's rather constrictive when getting around, they had worked with, this, by the way, wasn't even a biblical law. There's no law about how far you could walk on Sabbath. But the scribes had worked up some such law. They found a way of getting around it in hardship cases by going out the day before and putting some of your goods 2,000 feet apart over some distance that you're planning to go. And then you're never more than 2,000 feet from your property, if you like. They had found that the sabbatical year was a hardship on people under a situation of high taxes and such, so they would sell their land to somebody for a year and let them farm it, and then get it back at the end of the year, and they get the income on it, even though they wasn't been serving status. So there's a number of things like that which are not too helpful, plus some very interesting things in the rabbinical oral tradition as well. The rabbinical material is all up until about 200 AD. Now, some of it goes back into this earlier period. You can look at the fact of saying it comes from the earlier period, but it wasn't written down before 200. And so you have that fuzziness of being generations away from the event. We have some descriptions of various activities in the temple, descriptions particularly of key teachers from about a generation before Jesus, Hillel and Shammai, etc. But apparently all that material was carried orally by the disciples until 200. They're very careful carrying it, but still at that distance when it's all oral, things begin to get a little confused. But that's really what we say. Well, I don't want to go into a long discussion of all the terminology used here. The big collection of oral tradition of the rabbis was first written down in a very condensed form about 200 AD. One called the Mishnah. And that was so condensed that several generations later, a lot of the students were wondering what it meant. And so they began to get comments from the teachers, etc., on what it meant. And these comments were added to the Mishnah. And the Mishnah plus these comments seem to be called the Talmud, overloading you with the name of the comment. But the Mishnah, about 200, has been finally written down as a Talmud. And Talmud's written down a couple of centuries after that. So you have the Roman Talmud at 550 and the Palestinian Talmud at 400. In the Talmud, we have a few statements that didn't make it into the Mishnah, but go back into that time. And that's what this statement is. We're looking at right here, this phrase, Baraita. That you have on a handout sheet, which you've got somewhere here on the other sheet, is an example of this. And then we'll sing down to Sanhedrin 43a. Sanhedrin is the name of one of the subdivisions of the Mishnah Talmud. And it's materials about how the Sanhedrin is supposed to function. You've got about 60 little sections with different names like this, of what you're supposed to do on the Day of Atonement, and what you're supposed to do on the Sabbath, and what you're supposed to do on various other things. And they've all got fairly descriptive names, if you know a little bit of Aramaic or Hebrew. Most of them aren't descriptive, unless if you don't know that, although this one, Sanhedrin, is fairly helpful. Well, 43a is just how to find it. Here we got it. On the eve of Passover, Yeshua was hanged. For 40 days before his execution, a herald went forth and cried, "He is going to be stoned because he has practiced sorcery and enticed Israel to apostasy. Anyone who complains in his favor, let him come forward and plead on his behalf." But since nothing was brought forward in his favor, he was hanged on the eve of Passover. Several things of interest here. One, this name Yeshua, as you may know from any contact with Messianic Jews, is in fact the Jewish, the Hebrew form of Jesus. So Jesus is a Greek form, and this was the Hebrew form, Yeshua. So with the right name, his being put to death on the eve of Passover could be argued a little on the terminology there, but it seems to fit the way the Gospel of John mentions it, the eve of Passover. There's some argument among scholars today whether the Last Supper was a Passover held at the right time, a Passover held a day early because Jesus knew he was given the cross when the Passover lamb was slain. So there's some argument about that, but this at least fits in with that sort of thing. So that's rather interesting. The remark about 40 days is a little tricky to know exactly what to make of it, but fits well the remark in John that people would be thrown out of the synagogue if they even admitted Jesus as Messiah, if they already before he was put to death. And remarks about the authorities trying to figure out how to put him to death. So there may already be claims of some sort that he's going to be put to death going around, even from official circles, before the time comes. And remember, the disciples are a little afraid to go up even to the raising of Lazarus with Jesus because they're afraid that going back to Jerusalem is being fulfilled. So surely some period of time before Jesus went to Jerusalem last time, there were definitely ideas in the air that Jesus was going to be put to death. You see that pretty clearly here. What is a little strange about this passage is this mark about being stoned. And it may be that the authorities intended to have him stoned. The Jews would not normally crucify anybody. That's not a Jewish method of punishment. They considered it quite barbaric. In fact, I think most of the Romans considered it barbaric. But the Jews did not have the right to carry out the death penalty at this time. They had to get permission from the Romans, and therefore had to get a charge on which they could convince the Romans and such. But it may be they intended to stone him. The remark about hanged, notice, is actually what's used in regard to being put to death. On the eve of Passover, Yeshua was hanged. Since nothing was brought forward in his favor, he was hanged on the eve of Passover. Whether the passage is to be understood that he was stoned and hanged, which would be a Jewish procedure. You stone the person, and then if it's a particularly abominable crime, you hang up the body for at least 30 times, an example. Or whether what is actually intended here is he was actually hanged, because that term is the term used in the Talmud for crucifixion. And then the what they're intended to do is stone him. I can't tell you for sure how that goes, but what we do have here does otherwise fit in with what we know from the biblical sources. He practiced sorcery and enticed Israel to apostasy. Remember from the New Testament that the claim was he was casting out demons by means of demons, that his power was satanic. Well, that would fit in with this kind of a claim here. He's doing magic instead of really being from God. So that's the same picture that we get in the Gospels of what the Jewish officials thought about him. And enticing Israel to apostasy, they felt very strongly that he was doing something which ought not to be done, though they couldn't claim a charge on them by much. They tried to make their whole attempt about his claim to build up the temple, they tried to frame probably as a sorcery charge, and they couldn't do much with it. They obviously had some reservations about what he said about the law, but they apparently couldn't figure out what to do with it. They couldn't get some way to stick anything. What they finally charged Jesus with is blasphemy for claiming to be God. Of course, the only trouble with that is that blasphemy. But here we just get the general remark, apostasy, without a characterization of what the kind of apostasy they had in mind. And whether the person who cited this really knew, or whether he just didn't want to bring up the subject, we really don't know much about it. They think this is authentic. Now, you get a little split, I think. I think probably the more Orthodox Jews are willing to grant that the Jesus was tried religiously and convicted. The more liberal Jews don't want to go with that. They want to get as far away as they can from the Jews having anything to do with the death of Christ. So in liberal Jewish circles, you tend to get it's almost going to Roman totally. As is common also in liberal, Christian circles with quotations around it, a tendency to try and do the same thing. As we'll see here, this is pretty clearly a statement that as far as the Pharisees, the rabbis are concerned, Jesus was put together for religious crime. That fits the biblical picture. The Sanhedrin convicted him of religious crime, but to get anything that the Romans would pay attention to, they tried to convert it to political crime. And what obviously works best in that direction is to walk off the messiahship idea and claim that on the one hand, claiming something blasphemous by claiming to be son of God, and on the other hand, claiming to be Messiah, claiming to be a king, which is therefore treason against the emperor. And you can see that actually working out in the gospel account as they shift the charge when they come over and bring him before Pilate, because they're aware that Pilate won't put him to death for a religious crime when there's as much religious diversity as there is among the Jews. And exactly the same thing happening, very similar thing happening when the Jews tried to get Paul tried before Gallio at Corinth in Acts 19 or something like that, maybe a chapter off, where he says, look, if this were a matter of some civil crime, I'd listen to you. But since it's a matter of your own law, settle it yourself. I'm not going to let you do it. You could state that. Well, that's what they were apparently afraid of. So they did. Yeah. Well, what's interesting about this, then, is this whole theme of religious trial that he took to death for. There are a few other remarks in the Talmud. There's a remark elsewhere of someone, and it seems to be of Jesus, that he scorned the words of the wise. See how the Pharisees would view things that way when he argued them down on several occasions in his ministry. Then there's a remark which reads variously in different copies of the Talmud. He came to add rather than to subtract from the law, or he came neither to add nor to subtract from the law. The second one sounds a little bit more like what's going on in the Sermon on the Mount. Then there's this phrase, ben pantira. This phrase occurs several times in the Talmud, and I'm not sure anybody would have known what to make of it, except that we have a pagan writer from the 2nd century, later than our cutoff time, a fellow named Sulpice, who writes a book attacking Christianity. It's probably the earliest, what we might call, liberal life of Christ, except the pagan life of Christ, not like liberal life of Christ, in which he gathers up a lot of Jewish arguments being used at his time, and tries to spread them in pagan circles to keep people from converting to Christianity. And what this fellow Sulpice says is that Ben Pantera is a reference to Jesus' real father. Claim that Jesus' real father was the one who played the Ben Pantera. Well, now that that term then occurs in the Talmud, the term is probably linked to what Sulpice says about it, and a claim that Jesus was of illegitimate birth. Most commentators today doubt that Pantera was ever intended to be the name of a Roman soldier, so the Romans had enough different people in the army, I suppose you might be defined from nationality if you had a name like that. F.F. Bruce and his work, Jesus and Christian Origins Outside the New Testament, I'm going to mention here as they work for the Jesus for the reading in the very interested, suggests that we may have a rabbinic play on the claims of virgin birth in this passage. Pantera is something like the Greek word for virgin, parthenos. His suggestion is that the Jews, in mocking Jesus, made some kind of play on the word parthenos to do it with. About this much can be said for Bruce's claim. We do have in the Talmud several places where they make plays on words in an anti-Christian context. The word for gospel in Greek is euangelion, and in the Talmud there's a reference to an euangelion, a scroll of iniquity, which quite clearly in the context is some kind of a religious document, apparently is the rabbinic pun word for Christian gospel. That sort of thing occurs may be right about what Bruce may be right about what's going on here. My suggestion I haven't run into anywhere else, I just happen to run across the word in Greek, is that maybe pantera is a slight variation in Aramaic from the Greek pantheros, which means father-in-law, and that they are making a snide jibe at the genealogy which we see in Luke. So apparently the genealogy goes back to Joseph's father-in-law, that it goes back to Mary's side of the genealogy, rather than going back to Joseph's side of the genealogy. And that would then be kind of a hint of rabbinic claim to illegitimate birth. In fact, we see some remarks in the Gospel of John which suggest that Jews were circulating such a claim during Jesus' lifetime. This passage here, two of them together in John 8, would be worth taking a quick look at here, if you've got available. John 8, starting with verse 12 and running on, we have a real head-to-head conflict between Jesus and the Pharisees. And basically, they are trying to discount Jesus' claim. And Jesus says, I'm not the only one who's making these claims. I have other witnesses that support my claim. And he begins to sketch out what those supporting witnesses are. And one of them is his father. And then the Pharisees ask him this question, who is your father? Verse 19, I don't have that down in my notes. But that's very possibly a hint that they did not think that his father was Joseph. Joseph would be dead by now anyway, you think. And then, who are you? Verse 25. But this is looking more towards some hints of a claim to deity that he makes in the context. And then notice this remark up in verse 41, and that's definitely in the notes. We are not illegitimate children. The only father we have is God himself. And then down in verse 48, aren't we right in saying that you're Samaritan? Well, they knew he was not from Samaria. They knew he was from Galilee. The Samaritan was understood at the time, and was still understood by many today, to be a half-Jew. Somebody who's Jewish, but not all Jewish, but he's Jewish. If I were to make a guess on what's going on here, as soon as Jesus began to attract great attention early in his ministry, Pharisees began to look into his background. What would they find out if they looked into his background? They certainly wouldn't find out he was born of a virgin, because Mary did not advertise that. Joseph did not advertise that. What they would have found out if they'd gone back to Nazareth, they're going to go back to. No reason for them to go looking in Bethlehem. They don't like to know anything about that. And in fact, we see a couple of remarks indicate they don't know anything about that. This guy's from Galilee. Why should we expect any prophet to come from Galilee? And such. That's in fact just back in our passage earlier in the chapter of John. If they go back, what are they going to find out? They're going to find out that Mary and Joseph were engaged, and then Mary left town for a few months. And when she came back, she was obviously pregnant. But Joseph married her anyway, and they went off and had the child somewhere else. And then they didn't come back for a few years. Well, I don't think it'd be too hard to figure out what opponents of Jesus would make out of that. So I think that's what we see going on here in this material. And they don't want to attract a lot of attention to Jesus, but I think that's what's going on. Number 4 and 5 here on the page, some references to Jesus' disciples appear to be made, puns on their names. I don't know if you can make much out of that, whether they're looking around for names to make puns on, whether they really need the 12 disciples. The only of the 12 disciples that might show up in that list is Matthai, not Matthew. And then this remark I made about the pun on you on Gileon. Okay, so that's really what we've got in the rabbinic material. Several materials which we're not quite sure whether about Jesus or not. The Ben Pantera stuff, which is presumably about Jesus on the basis of this pagan Celsus collection of Jewish material. And then this one about Yeshua, which is surely about Jesus, since it doesn't fit anybody else in here about antiquity. When we try and put all this together, we have what I've given you in 65 of my syllabus. First of all, Jesus lived in Judea during the governorship of Pontius Pilate, what we get from Josephus, the same thing that we get from Pastor. Jesus was there during Pontius Pilate. The Talmud doesn't give any kind of information that's very helpful, but what it does give would put it in the same ballpark. It's a baraita, that is, it's from the period before the Mishnah. If something happened back there before 200, but that's always been kind of coming up. It's consistent, but doesn't really give you much information on when it happened. The Talmud suggests that his birth was unusual, but goes for an illegitimate option. And we see the hints of that in Jesus' lifetime in John 8. Character was controversial. It's pretty clear that whichever version of Josephus you're looking at, he's very favored in Jesus. He's a wise man. He's one who did good things. But on the other hand, the Talmud, the rabbinic side, is very opposed to him. He's one who scorned the words of wise. They're wise. And he scorned them. So he can't be wise. Scorned the words of wise. Josephus, his conduct was good and virtuous. And Talmud enticed Israel to apostasy. What we see in this material is a mixture reaction to Jesus. What we see in the pagans, a mixture reaction to Jesus. Superstition on the one hand, and a wise king on the other hand. Now, that's not going to change. You go all the way back to the time Jesus came. That's the way it was then. You should not expect that if you go back to earlier and earlier things, you'd like Jesus. He put him to death. And even once he's been put him to death, he exposed his king. Controversy surrounds Jesus from the very moment he was began his public ministry. He runs all the way through his ministry, and naturally runs all the way down beyond. Once you get safely all 5 or 6 centuries, you can say, yeah, Jesus was a good man, but he wasn't really claimed and that sort of thing. But what you're really doing there is just getting to express the data we've got to go that in that direction. And that, I think, is misused with false information. So his character was controversial. He worked miracles, also controversial. Notice what Josephus says. Doer of wonderful work, that is the Arabic condensation of it, about whom the prophets have recounted wonders, even if that's more accurate, he thought that some wonders were associated with it. The Talmud practiced sorcery. What's interesting here, then, is that the earliest sources we have about Jesus have been doing miracles. There's a guy who don't want to believe in miracles, it's for that I too. But this is some stuff even from opponents that have been doing miracles. But since they don't believe miracles occur, you've got to get rid of it. But by any straightforward historical methodology that allows the possibility that miracles ever occurred in history, you've got as good evidence that Jesus' miracles if he did to anybody. The people in his favor said he did them. The people who opposed him said he did them. People from the very earliest period said he did them. Whereas for someone like Muhammad, nothing said about his doing miracles in early material. In fact, the Quran rings up again and again. Why hasn't he been given any signs by God? And he says, stop, this book means nothing. God didn't give him the ability to do miracles. And miracles about Muhammad only begin to show up after a couple of centuries. You get away from it. He begin to show up. If you're sure about miracles, Jesus show up in the early sources. Fifthly, he gathered followers who considered him to be the Messiah. Clearly, both versions of Josephus on Jesus mentioned the many followers, Jews and Gentiles, mentioned the Messianic claim. The Talmudic material doesn't say anything about Messiah, but it does say he enticed Israel to apostasy, which is certainly going to be gathered to follow some sort. And then on the one hand, Josephus, regarding his death, says he was condemned by Pilate, if the Arabic and Greek version say that, and the Greek version of Josephus adds the addition he was accused by the Jews, which my suggestion is that was probably just edited out in shortening the passage in Philadelphia. But whether we treated that as the original or not, this fellow, Shlomo Kness, down here at the bottom of the handout sheet, the fellow who published this Arabic version, he tries to argue that the original Josephus said nothing about Jews being involved in the trial, and that it was put in by whoever Christianized the version. But my argument the other way around. It was condensed out by the epitomizer. And the reason I would argue that is the Talmud has clearly a Jewish trial in view in the whole matter. And there's no reason why the rabbi would go out of the way to make it a religious trial if in fact they thought he was put to death by the Romans. In fact, both we again see with the Jewish material, just as with the pagan material, that the Romans were involved, you get some people who are anti-Semitic, want to make it all the Jews. And some people who want to let the Jews off the hook, make it all the Romans. But the material, not only the Bible, but the extra-biblical material, there's the pagan material and the Greek material, there's both of them on that. And the idea that you can call the Jews Christ killers is not right, because we're all involved. He set it, God set it up in such a way that all mankind would be involved in death through the rulers. And then number seven, he was put to death. Josephus makes it crucified and the Talmud hanged or possibly stoned and hanged. I've been looking over the passage more here and wondering whether they actually claimed he was stoned or not, or whether that was the intention. But anyway, what it said is it was pretty close to being consistent with the Josephus passage, and pretty close to the New Testament there with no one said stone. And then the day one passed over Eve. And then in Josephus, the disciples reported his resurrection on the third day. So as we look over these materials, we don't see as much material as we'd like. And you might wonder why there's not more. Why Jesus did all those miracles? Why isn't it reported all over his life? Well, think a little bit about our own century in Christianity and this century. There are an awful lot of things that happen in Christian circles that don't make it to the secular press. Why not? There's several reasons. One of them is they aren't interested in it, and another, they aren't interested in attracting attention to it. And that may well be the case that happens at this time as well. We would not be surprised if persons writing a century later in Rome might wonder whether there was any truth to stories of being out of Palestine from 70 years ago. Persons at the time might feel differently, but that's something that could dry up later. I try and give you a little summary here on the non-Christian sources in page 66. We've not really got time to go through it here, but basically the picture that the idea that Jesus never existed, we've seen Allegro, that's a standard Marxist picture about Jesus, has to really stump all of the historical evidence, not just the Christian historical evidence. And the idea that only the Jews were involved in his death, or only the Romans were involved in his death, means you have to dump out evidence from both of these kinds of sources. It's pretty clear that Jesus was thought to be a teacher, a miracle worker, and a person who claimed to be Messiah. And yet your liberal views almost invariably pick one of those to go with his views and throw out the other two. But the extra-biblical evidence points to that other piece. And as we see, all the liberals are generally willing to see this, Jesus both attracted and repelled people at his time. He made a division. That's what he said he came to do. He came to make a division, and they didn't explain what he means by it, but this I think is what he means by it. That some people are going to be turned off because they don't want anybody to be seen. And other people will be attracted because they see the forgiveness of him. But not as much as we'd like on the resurrection, but I think probably as much as we would expect on the resurrection from sources that did not believe in resurrection. The Stoic Mera is obviously favorable to Jesus, but Stoics don't believe in resurrection. The only other guy that's favorable to Jesus in our sources is Josephus, and he does mention at least a report of the resurrection. Okay. Not as much as we'd like, but I think there's quite enough to suggest that the ideas of going in various resulting actions really have to go against the evidence we've got.